From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Women's educational opportunities in 19th century Georgia were few and far between. Finishing schools focused on genteel skills like art, music, and French rather than rigorous academics. The Lucy Cobb Institute changed that. It opened in Athens in 1859 and taught young women these skills alongside math and science classes. The Institute cemented Athens as a place for women's education in the South. Fran Teague is professor of theater, film studies, and English at the University of Georgia, and she joins me from Athens along with UGA student Kristen Gragg. They presented their research called Hidden Histories, Educating Women in Athens Before 1919 at UGA, and join me now together from Athens. Welcome to both of you.
Welcome back at you. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, glad you're here. I'm hearing from Fran. How about Kristen?
Right.
Hey, I'm here.
Good to know. Fran, start with you. Bring us back to Georgia in the 1800s. What was women's education like during that time?
Oh, everyone's education was so different because it depended on things like race and class and sex. If you were a black woman, African-American woman, for example, as a slave, it was illegal to educate you. If you were of the yeoman class, you would have perhaps a little bit of education. In the 1850s, there was a study done that literacy for women was 2/3 of the population were literate. The rest of them weren't in some parts of the region. But for a young woman who was white and of the elite class, you were probably educated at home by tutors, and then you might be sent out of the region to a seminary in the north.
So what were some arguments for women's education at the time?
Well, there are two strong arguments. The first is from the heart. Parents love their children. And they would have a bright, curious little girl, and they would want that child to be able to follow her interests or what made her excited. And the other argument, as I sometimes say in class, is from the womb. And that is to say they wanted children or young women to be better mothers. And they will talk over and over again, not about the child's brain, but about her becoming a mother. That was a given.
So what were some of the arguments against educating women?
Well, you know, they're only going to be mothers, and so that's really not terribly important. A lot of those arguments are turned around, and the argument from the heart is turned around as if you give her too many options, a woman will be unhappy with her lot in life.
So, Fran, while you were researching this, what did you find about what women did learn in finishing schools?
Well, as you said, in finishing schools, it was mostly things like music, art. I'm not sure why French is such a favorite language, but it is. There's one course that was taught, I believe, at Lucy Cobb in wax, fruit, and flower arranging, which I always thought was a wonderful subject. A lot of morals, a lot of etiquette.
So skills you may need, maybe some not. So, Kristen, the Lucy Cobb Institute was then founded in the 1850s. What was the Cobb family's interest in educating girls?
Well, my research was primarily into the Cobb Institute itself, but the Cobb family was an Athens dynasty, essentially, very popular, wealthy, prominent. They were responsible for the creation of the Institute. The lawyer, Thomas R. Cobb, was the father of a young girl named Lucy, who was about to finish her education at the Athens Female Academy. And the Institute itself, the idea came from a letter that ran in the Southern Banner from an anonymous mother who was, again, advocating for educating women because it would make them better mothers, essentially.
So did they start this school? What was the response?
The Athens community loved it, essentially. Women came from all over the South. The first class was about 300, I think, on the first day. So it had a very good response.
So what was the Institute like in Athens? What did young women who attended experience or learn?
Well, like you said before, there were gentility lessons, but they also had an education on math and science. Well, science came a little bit later, but they were taught math, Latin, Bible studies, all sorts of different courses. Again, wax sculpture making.
But educating them beyond just being mothers.
Yes, absolutely.
So this was a critical year, of course, 1859, when the school opened in January. This is just before the Civil War. And the Lucy Cobb Institute reflected the norms of the South at the time. Fran, how did educational bodies like this spread Confederate viewpoints?
Well, in this case, the principal who would ultimately take over the school, one of the teachers there, was firmly committed to the values of the Confederacy, and she was eager to spread those values with her students. I guess the other thing to point out is that the family itself was very active. T.R.R. Cobb, the gentleman who helped to get the school open and who had it named for his daughter, was the person who spent a lot of time writing the Constitution of the Confederate States of America, and he would himself enlist and die in battle.
The woman that you mentioned, is that Mildred Rutherford?
Yes, and Kristen's the expert on her.
All right, so Kristen, she eventually took over the Institute. How'd she get connected, and what was her leadership like?
Well, she was part of the family, married into the Cobbs, and she was an excellent teacher. She wrote her own textbooks for her students, including Latin, math, oratory. But she was, again, a very outspoken secessionist, very against African-American students. She kept a slave on the campus. So, again, you're taking the good with the bad. She did teach her students a lot. She brought Athens the Seamy Stovall Chapel, which is a huge center, cultural center for us now. But she was very outspoken against African-Americans attending the college, against the South being part of the Union, all of that.
She's also against women's suffrage, which find terribly ironic.
I'm speaking with UGA Professor Fran Teague and UGA student Kristen Gregg, who researched the Lucy Cobb Institute, which really changed the game and brought women's education to Athens during the 20th century, during the 19th century, and also flourished in the 20th century.
It wasn't the only women's college, though. I want to just make it clear. There was also Wesleyan College down in Macon. You had Spelman College after the war, settled in Atlanta, and Decatur Female Seminary, which turned into Agnes Scott. And I think it's fascinating that Georgia has four really effective women's schools in the 19th century, even though the women who were not able to get to those would often receive a very weak education.
Okay, so why do you think that is? That why here in the South, in Georgia in particular, there were those opportunities?
Oh, I think it was the communities. I mean, Athens is a college town. Those professors wanted their daughters getting an education. Macon clearly adopted Wesleyan early and spent a lot of, it was a matter of civic pride. Same thing in Atlanta. The slaves who were freed would make their way to Atlanta and wanted, they were very ambitious to learn all the things that had been denied to them. Agnes Scott in Decatur is a kind of companion school to places like Georgia Tech or to Emory for most of its history.
Kristen, the school, Lucy Cobb School, did have some famous alumni. Mildred Mell became principal in 1922. What was her experience with higher ed in the 1900s?
So she was a very accomplished woman for her time. She actually did go on to become the principal of the Economics College at Agnes Scott. But prior to that, she took classes at UGA before women were officially admitted. She got a degree from the University of Wisconsin. And she returned to Athens, and that's when she became the principal there and started teaching the students. And then again went on to become get a PhD from the University of North Carolina in economics and sociology.
So there was also Julia Flisch. She became an advocate for women's education after she graduated from the school in 1877. What's her story?
So Julia Flisch, again, a very accomplished woman. She was kind of quoted as being the most outspoken proponent for women getting the right to vote in Georgia. She originally applied to go to the University of Georgia for classes, and they denied her, even in the summer sessions. And then she eventually went on to go to Harvard, so we kind of messed up on that one.
Okay, Fran, you're laughing. What's going on here?
I just love Julia Flisch. I think she's a marvelous character, and I also love the stories about her career as a labor organizer.
Mm-hmm. So quite a shift from the days of Mildred Rutherford.
Oh, yes.
So maybe the idea or the fears that women with their own mind might make their own decisions came true.
Education always gives you options. That's one of the things that's great about it, or threatening.
The Lucy Cobb Institute did eventually close in 1931. Why?
Well, the Great Depression really took a toll on the investments that came into the college. And also, when they petitioned UGA for help, financial aid, they didn't get it from them because of they previously refused to combine with UGA. And so they just kind of fell into financial ruin, even though they survived the Civil War, all those early conflicts. They just couldn't meet the financial needs.
Kristen, I'm wondering how doing this research changed you as a student, or what did it reveal or surprise or make you rethink your ideas about your own place in higher ed?
So I'm very grateful for the people who came before me and fought for my right to be here today. That was the biggest takeaway I took from it, is that I can't take what I've been given for granted. You know, I need to take all the opportunities I can, because women before me didn't really have that opportunity to be here and to do research at the university, much less even be on the campus, you know?
Well, friend, March is National Women's History Month. What would you say, or why would you say it's important to learn about this kind of history? What does it help us understand?
Well, I think, first of all, it helps us understand that education does give us options. And the second thing I'd say is, for an important takeaway, I would suggest that every student go and ask their grandparents, what was your education like? We forget that history, and we forget some important moments in our culture's history.
So when you're presenting an academic paper like this on your research, it is going into a somewhat closed circle. How are you telling the story of Lucy Cobb School outside of that circle?
I'm not. I hope Kristen is. I actually got interested in it because at Sini Stovall Chapel on the Lucy Cobb campus is a wonderful historic theater, and that's one of the central interests I have as a theater historian. Krista, who is, by the way, a Ronald McNair Fellow, I think that's so cool.
Bravo.
She asked me if there was something she could research, and I said, well, there's this school that has a historic theater. Go figure out something about it. And so she has been the one educating me.
Well, thank you.
I love that.
Really appreciate you both telling this story today. Fran Teague, Professor of Theater Film Studies and English at the University of Georgia. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
And UGA student Kristen Gregg, congratulations and thank you.
Thank you.
Now you can find out more about the Lucy Cobb Institute and women's education in Georgia at our website, gpbnews.org. Now, just a note on women's education. Razia John is among the guests for discussion and film screening this Friday to celebrate International Women's Day here at GPB. She started a school for girls in a rural village in Afghanistan, place run by former Taliban strongholds. And from 7 to 10, we'll have a panel discussion and a documentary screening at this event on Friday night. For more information and to RSVP for the free event, you can go to gpb.org. You can also watch a live stream of the conversation. Coming up, Big Fish author Daniel Wallace discusses his upcoming nonfiction work about family and about loss. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us for more on Second Thought after a short break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. North Carolina-based author Daniel Wallace is best known for his works of fiction, like the novel-turned-movie Big Fish. In recent years, he's focused more on nonfiction. Whether creating worlds or interpreting the one we live in, great writing speaks to big truths. And Daniel Wallace says his forays into nonfiction for The Bitter Southerner led him to a new project. William was an outdoorsman and admired by his family for the full life that he lived. Unfortunately, William ended that life by his own hand. Daniel Wallace talked about the project with Bitter Southerner editor Chuck Reese.
You told me before we got on the air here, I asked you if you were working on your next novel, and you told me that you were working on a book of nonfiction stories. And I would love to hear a little bit about that and about why you're kind of moving in that direction.
Yeah, getting into that form, things started to feel fresher to me. Not that every novel is not new and different and impossible, but you talk about kind of chance meetings and chance in general, I think, is so important in the life of a artist and a writer and a publisher, for that matter. But after my sister died in 2011, we were going through her things, and I found this big box of journals, like 25 journals, all written by her husband, William Neely, who had killed himself in 2001. And at the time, and actually through all time, it was something of a mystery why he had done this. He was an incredibly gifted artist. He would definitely be in the Bitter Southerner if he were alive. He was a writer and an illustrator, a cartoonist. He mapped all the great southern rivers. He was a kayaker, a mountain climber, and published 10 books on how to be in the world, in the outside world, doing these things. He was sui generis, but he was also the kind of man that I think a lot of men wanted to be. Hmm. And I had his diaries for a really long time before I looked at them, because I had to battle with this idea of what it meant to do that, to look at the private writing of somebody that you know, or anybody. His life was really that of two people in one. The William that we got to see, who did all these amazing heroic things, and then this other secretive, dark William, who was so full of self-loathing and insecurity and inability really to see a place for himself in the world where he felt secure and happy, and who in fact had been working toward killing himself for 30 years. And his journals document that. And so that's, there's a lot of other things going on in this book, but that's it in a nutshell.
I'm expectant to read that. And it makes me want to ask you a question, too. I mean, I think that, you know, you dwell particularly in pretty dark territory. And one of the things that I've always found about your writing is that that's not the case. You know, so many of the books, and at least this is my opinion, so many of the books that we think of as classics among Southern literature tend to have pretty dark subject matter at the heart of them. But every time I've ever read one of your novels, I have always felt that there was at the heart of them this essential sweetness. As you move into this kind of nonfiction thing more fully, is that something that you intend to retain? Is that just part of who you are as a writer and a human being, or have you even thought about that at all?
I have thought about it, because the nature of this book is a little bit darker. I think that you're right. It's important to me to provide a light somewhere there, and it's because I feel like it's my role as a writer to do that. I don't get any joy out of writing a story that says everything sucks, period.
I don't think those do any of us much good.
No, they don't do any of us good. But in telling a story about this incredible person, I think that I'm trying to not only celebrate him and all his complexity, but it also the act of storytelling itself is a light. And one of the reasons, of the many reasons he killed himself, is because he didn't tell his story. He was his own double agent and did not share that interior world, even with the woman he loved, my sister, more than anything. Not being able to tell your story for whatever reason is not a good thing. And that's part of the reason that I want to tell it. And honestly, he, one of his last, he loved to write to-do lists. Mm-hmm. And one of his last lists was to destroy his journals. He'd been working toward killing himself for decades, but he seriously was putting things together for a good week, you know, getting all his papers in order and whatnot. So he had every opportunity to do that. He didn't. And my sister found them and read them. And then she had every opportunity to destroy them. And she didn't. And so this is the intellectual kind of cavern that I, you know, was in when I was trying to just make my mind up as to whether this was appropriate for me to do, to really get this perspective on somebody's life and know somebody better than I know anybody. Now, you know, knowing him, knowing both sides of him, I know him better than I know myself. And so what I think is happening here, or what I like to believe is happening here, is that he did want his story told. He just couldn't tell it himself.
That is maybe the most elegant summation I've ever heard of the value of storytelling in and of itself. Because without it, if we don't tell what's inside of us, it becomes something we have to wrestle with internally, which can cause problems in a variety of organs in the body.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely believe that's true, especially now.
That's North Carolina-based author Daniel Wallace speaking with Chuck Reese for the Bitter Southerner podcast, a collaboration between GPB and the Bitter Southerner magazine. You can subscribe for free at gpb.org/podcasts. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us for more on Second Thought right after the break. Plenty of people pay lots of money for a Beyoncé concert, but what about paying for a Beyoncé class for credit? A group of college students at Valdosta State University is studying the work of Queen Bee this semester. Their focus is on Lemonade, the megastar's sixth studio album, accompanied by a visual album on HBO. I got hot sauce in my bags. I see it, I want it, want it. I suck yellow. We're listening to the single Formation from Lemonade. Katarina Orr is adjunct instructor of African American Studies at Valdosta State, and she's getting her students information to learn all about the messages in Lemonade. And she's joining us now on the line. Katarina, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the course is called AFAM 3600, Black
yes.
Women in Modern America. Why Beyoncé and why Lemonade?
Well, Beyoncé, of course, she is a music icon, and she is someone that young people readily identifies with. And Lemonade, because it sparks the conversation about many things that African-American women, or maybe even women in general, have to deal with as it relates to feminism and empowerment and intersectionality.
Yeah, there's so much here. What else is included in the syllabus for the class?
Well, the way that it's set up, it's first of all, our text comes from the Lemonade syllabus that was created by Candace Benbow. And what I did was I just perused those lists of books that she collected to see what would better fit this course and what I was going for. And then it's broken down by themes. And generally, these themes can be found within Lemonade. But as it relates to Black women in modern America, we discuss what is feminism. We discuss things such as our Black bodies, the angry Black woman stereotype, and the actual movement, if you will. We discuss the women's suffrage movement and African-American women's place within that, Black love and feminism, and it just goes on so forth, like that.
Well, you know, you dig into it for a semester. We're going to dig into it in a big way today.
Right.
The making of Lemonade was a super well-kept secret, landed with a boom out of the blue in 2016, accompanied by a highly produced 65-minute film that went really far beyond the music video, and it's called a visual album.
Right.
And it is sequenced in a deliberate way to create a narrative arc. Are you studying it like that? You talked about the themes.
Yeah, we are. What we're doing is we're taking bits and pieces from the actual Lemonade, and then we expound on it because there are so many different things. I mean, there are even historical context within Lemonade that we discuss, like her appearance as the African goddess of Oshun when she dresses in her yellow and she comes out of the church with the water gushing out around her, in front of her, behind her. And of course, that is in Hold Up. And then within Love Drought, she is at the place of the Igbo landing where 75 slaves went into the water and drowned themselves as resistance toward slavery. So, yes, it is definitely a narrative arc, and we explore each one of these themes to its fullest.
So this has been described when it came out, a womanist fantasy, a revolutionary feminist masterpiece. And the subject, Beyoncé has definitely been a subject of argument since she emerged on the scene. You know, the question of, is she flaunting her beauty and sexuality as empowerment, or is she a pawn of the patriarchy? She herself resisted the title of feminist and then embraced it in a really big public way. How does she and Lemonade fit into Black feminist theory?
Well, because within her, within Lemonade, she discusses things dealing with race, class, and gender. Black feminism is intersectionality. So she discusses or she portrays things relating to Black women, being Black, being women, even women being in a specific socioeconomic class, because I know she deals with Katrina in Lemonade. And of course, we all know that it was the Ninth Ward, the poorest of New Orleans, that was majorly affected by Katrina.
Right. There's so much to unpack here. There's marital infidelity in the album, jealousy, healing, family, Black identity. And betrayal, a super big topic that many people try to decode, right? Because it's the relationship between two of our biggest, she is obviously the biggest pop star in the world right now, and her husband. Here she is. This is a little bit, throughout the album is these kind of punctuations of prose. This is intuition by the Somali British poet Warsan Shire, text written through the album.
I tried to make a home out of you. But doors lead to trapdoors. A stairway leads to nothing. Unknown women wander the hallways at night. Where do you go when you go quiet? You remind me of my father, a magician, able to exist in two places at once. In the tradition of men in my blood, you come home at 3 a.m. and lie to me. What are you hiding?
Boy, so much there. You remind me of my father, tradition in my blood. This highlights infidelity as a kind of generational curse. And there's a strong vision of the matriarchal line throughout. I couldn't help but think of women blues singers, R&B singers, talking about hard-hearted men and cheating men. We're going to come into a break in just a minute and hear some more music, but how do you think, how does your course deal with women telling their own stories of sexuality and relationships?
Well, I think what Beyoncé did was she opened the door for others to be able to tell their stories. When you see someone, and like you mentioned earlier, as beautiful and successful having to deal with infidelity, it's almost as if that's not supposed to happen. And so when it does, and she actually shows the world how she deals with it, because even within Lemonade, she goes through these stages of grief. Even with inner titles within the album, the virtual album, it allows women to be able to go through this as well and understand that it's not from a lack of strength. That's strength that allows. Yeah.
Katerina, we're going to take a quick break. Let's come back to this conversation. This is On Second Thought.
Okay.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're continuing our conversation about Beyoncé's Lemonade as text, as pop culture phenomenon, and as academic source. The 2016 Grammy-winning album and accompanying film has been hailed as both deeply personal, as a feminist masterpiece. Valdosta State University now offers students the chance to study the project for academic credit, and we'd love to hear from you. Did Beyoncé challenge you to think about pain and triumph or broaden your ideas of the Black female experience on Lemonade, the audio and visual album? Would you take a course on Beyoncé's Lemonade? Tweet us and let us know. We're at OST Talk, or join the conversation on our Facebook group, GPB's On Second Thought. And I'm joined by the instructor of the course, Katerina Orr. Katerina, is it a popular course?
Oh, wow. It is extremely popular. This is the first semester that we have offered it, and we have a huge waiting list. As a matter of fact, we went on and did some overrides. There were so many students. So I have close to 30, and you have to understand, Valdosta State University, while it's a nice size school, I think the normal amount of students for a humanities course, if you will, is 20, 25 at the very, very most. So it is amazingly popular, well-received, and we're very excited about it.
So this was seen in many ways as an album for Black women. What is the demographic like of the class?
The demographic is all Black women and two Black men.
Well, so any course in feminism has to deal with masculinity. And you mentioned right before the break, you know, that Beyoncé, so beautiful, so successful, infidelity is not supposed to happen to somebody like her. And throughout the album, she expresses pain and anger towards Jay-Z, her husband. He appears late in the film. Mm-hmm. So what kind of views of masculinity do we get from this?
I think that, well, number one, maybe not necessarily from Lemonade, I'm sure there is, but the fact that Jay-Z had a response to Lemonade, where he actually apologizes. Hmm. Where for me, his apology came when he participated in Lemonade. I think that we saw some humility there that my students definitely appreciate. He was allowed to tell his story subsequently about being emotionless, not necessarily understanding or ever learning how to be able to show emotions. And I think that is one thing that he learned from Beyoncé, which is why he was willing to assist her in her, because I think what that did for her, it allowed her to feel closure within this whole process. Mm-hmm. And he participated in her ability to have closure, mm-hmm. which I think speaks to his masculinity.
Right, and this the album 444 was kind of his response. But you know, he's a guy who was in the game. You know, he made his mark, you know, 20 something years ago, what, back in the 90s, you know, as a man of the street. And now he has to be soft. You know, in one way, it's traditional. He's saying, "Can you forgive me?" In others, She's been outperforming and out-earning him for decades. How do you think Lemonade in this dynamic gets us to reconsider power for Black women?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it allows them to embrace their power. It lets them know that they have power and that a relationship works according to the two people within that relationship. I think the bottom line of it all is, you know, Beyonce and Jay-Z, I think it's very obvious that they love each other. They're very private with their life, which is so amazing that she even would do Beyonce, she would even do Lemonade because of how private that they are. I think they understand that love exists between two people. You cannot invite the public eye into that life. Mm. And I think that she shows this for women, and both of them together also shows for women that you can be powerful and you can still be a wife and you can still be a mother and you can still do all of these things successfully. And even in the midst of all that, you can be hurt. Mm. You can be hurt. You can feel as if you're not being validated. And even through that, you can bounce back.
Right. And this was a huge risk for somebody, a woman famously in control of her image. I think of the video Flawless, you know, I wake up this beautiful and out in the world. Beyonce has a platform for telling her side of this story.
Right.
How do you process that with students and, you know, young people who are considering how they tell their stories in the world?
Well, you know, it's funny that you ask that because one element of the class that the students do, they do journals. Every week they have to turn in a journal where they reflect on the discussions that were held in class. And one student in particular said that when Beyonce and Hold Up went down the street with the bat and hitting windows or breaking windows and hitting cars, it allowed me to believe and to understand and to know that my anger is okay. I am angry. It's okay to be angry. So she allowed them to be things, to feel things, and let them know it's okay to do so.
One of the most controversial elements of the film is her vision of police brutality or treatment of unarmed Black men. She has the mothers of Trayvon Martin and Eric Garner. And there was a big backlash by police to this, compounded by, in 2016, her Super Bowl performance, interpreted as, you know, very Black Panther party-ish. Mm-hmm. How are you using this to talk about those issues and the reaction of a Black woman with your students?
Well, you know, with it being the African American Studies program, that's just, you know, fodder for the course, if you will. Those are the things that we talk about in general, as it were. I just think that Beyonce provides another element wherein we can share that story of police brutality. Now, the funny thing to me about that backlash is, if I'm not mistaken, law enforcement said that they would not provide security in any way mm-hmm. for her anymore. I don't think that ever came to pass.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Beyonce is influential. And for someone to speak on that at such a huge level, I'm sure there is going to be backlash. It makes perfect sense. But, if you know, it didn't come to anything. So.
Well, she also started selling Boycott Beyonce T-shirts at her game. So a woman who's sort of like owning the storyline as well. And
right.
I'm just curious about that. You know, she's obviously a businesswoman. She knows exactly when to strike, how to leave an impact on culture. Everybody was talking about this record. So what have you learned, and how do you talk about that? You know, her stealthily dropping this album, nearly everyone is shocked and impressed with the results. How do you talk with your students about that?
Well, for one of the elements that we speak about in this class is the angry Black woman stereotype.
Yeah, she's like smashing car windows with a bat.
Right, exactly. Well, one thing I read an article just yesterday, and it said that Beyonce is definitely, actually, Rihanna was also mentioned in this conversation, but just Beyonce specifically, she uses her voice. She uses her voice, and sometimes that voice is angry, but it's accepted because of her being a music icon. Now, if this were 20 years ago, if this was 20 years ago, she would be seen as an angry Black woman. Yeah. But she is using her platform to express issues that everyday Black women cannot express, and she's doing it boldly and beautifully, all of these things. So the fact that she uses this platform and she's not afraid, and she is a businesswoman, because, you know, one of my students in class even said that this could be seen as a positive spin, where she took hold of this infidelity and she literally used it. Now, I'm not going to, well, she did use it to her advantage.
Well,
but she used it for the advantage of others as well.
Yeah, she owned it, and I think a lot of people followed that. Katrina Orr, thank you so much for talking with us.
Yes.
Valdosta State African American Studies Adjunct Instructor Katrina Orr. And of course, how can we leave you otherwise than Beyonce? This is All Night.
So many people that I know, they just trying to touch you. Kiss up and rub up and fill up. Kiss up and rub up and fill up on you. Give you some time to prove that I can trust you. Again, I'm gonna kiss up and rub up and fill up.
Pylon Reenactment Society will be performing at the Savannah Stopover Festival this weekend. Vanessa Briscoe-Hay fronts the Athens-based post-punk band. She added two tracks to our Georgia playlist of songs written or performed by Georgians.
Hi, this is Vanessa Briscoe-Hay. I'm speaking to you from Athens, Georgia, and I'm the singer for Pylon, Supercluster, and now Pylon Reenactment Society. Today, my first pick for the Georgia playlist is one of my favorite songs from 1968. It's by the Classics Four, and it's called Spooky.
First you say no, you got some plans for the night, and then you stop and say,
what you've got is you've got a band who's telling a story about a spooky little girl like you in 3 minutes. It has a really nice kind of jazzy, bluesy bottom to it. It kind of snakes around and twists in there. The saxophone is very important. There's a, I guess it's maybe a progenitor of what became soft rock. Spooky is a very appropriate name for the song.
Love is kind of crazy with a spooky little girl like you.
The song itself was actually taken from a jazz standard, and some members of the Classics Four had decided to add lyrics to it. It started out as a jazz saxophone, kind of bluesy kind of song, and then when you hear the song, you'll hear the lyrics as it's playing, but it kind of appealed to me as a kid because it was talking about a girl who was a little bit different. Spooky little girl like you. Spooky. My second pick for the Georgia playlist is from 1978 by Atlanta's own The Brains, and it's called Money Changes Everything. It goes out to my dear friend Margaret Adams.
She said, I'm sorry, baby. I'm leaving you tonight.
you know, it kind of represents what Atlanta was about at the time. It's very poppy, very well-written, and synthesizer-driven. Tom Gray released this initially as a single, and on the basis of the single, the Brains were signed to Mercury Records. This is just like a perfect pop song. They're like at the top of their game. The instruments are all very together, very professional sounding, which was maybe more of a hallmark to an Atlanta sound than Athens. I mean, there were a lot of bands that never really got signed or moved beyond the area. The Brains were one of the ones who did. When you hear a really good pop song like that, you realize what makes it tick. And to me, the clearness of the lyrics and the sentiment really come through. It's a just very punchy, very hooky pop song. I don't know that Pylon were ever accused of being very hooky or punchy or any of that. We were maybe left field from that. But I can say that I enjoyed that, and I had many friends in Atlanta who were associated with that band.
That's Vanessa Briscoe-Hay from Pylon Reenactment Society. You can catch the band live at the Savannah Stopover Festival on Saturday. There are more details on our website, gpbnews.org. That is it for our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Alex Word is our engineer, Don Smith, our dean of grammar, and Amy Kiley is senior producer. I'm Virginia Prescott. See you next time with On Second Thought.